Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. Having some technical difficulties here with Blog Talk Radio. I know that's nothing new, but hopefully we will be talking to my guest shortly. I'm having him call in to me because the difficulty was in calling him. So I have to talk for a couple of minutes while we're waiting for him to call in. So his name is Christopher D. Abbott, and he is a well-known author. He is fairly prolific as well, and a lot of his books are available on Amazon. And he has his own website, and he's not calling yet, even though I told him he could. Okay, so I hope that he's not having more trouble with his phone. I wanted to wait until he was on the phone to mention these books of his, but I'm going to go ahead and do that, and then if he hasn't called, I'm going to assume that he's not calling in. And hang on one second. I think he's here. Christopher?
Hi. Yes,
okay.
I made it. Sorry about that.
Okay. And you can hear me okay, right?
I can hear you just fine, yes. Thank you.
Okay, and I can hear you as well. And so when you listen to the recorded thing, you're going to hear me like, you know, talking, because I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to talk to wait for him to call in. So I just started talking. But I had just started to mention 13 of your books. So before we get started, I'm just going to do that as an introduction. So anybody that's listening, the gentleman who just answered when I was talking to him, his name is Christopher D. Abbott. And the 13 books that I started to tell you about was Sherlock Holmes, A Scandalous Affair, Sherlock Holmes, The Curse of Pharaoh, Progenitor, Citadel of Ra, Escaping Matilda, Rise of the Jackal King, Dr. Chandrix Dies, Sir Lawrence Dies, Daughter of Ra, Songs of the Osirian, and there's also a Songs of the Osirian Companion, Revolting Tales, Volume 1, and Beast, A New Beginning. And those are all available on Amazon. So, Christopher, first I wanted to have you talk about your website, and you can tell people about it, how they can get autographed books from you, and things like that. So go ahead and talk about your website for a few minutes.
Of course, and thank you so much, because this is the second time I've been on your show, so it's very good to hear your voice. And
thank you.
Yes, my website is it's very easy. It's www.cdanabbott.com. And on that site, I have a blog. I also have on the front page the newest of the books, and then I have like a store. The easiest method I found for people to communicate to me is either from there via email, or if they're on Facebook, to just message me on Facebook, and then I can do sort of personalized books and so on from there. So yes, go to that website or find me on Facebook, Christopher D. Abbott, A-B-B-O-T-T. You'll find my author page or my personal page, and connect with me. That will be awesome.
Yeah, and it would also be awesome for the people to get some autographed copies of your book, because they're not bad price. They're very reasonable prices, just for the people to know. And I also want everyone to know that my guest is a Reader's Favorite Award-winning author. And like he mentioned, he is returning to the show. So you, Christopher, are my very first returning guest. So thank you very much for that. I feel honored. So what I'm going to have you do is pretty much from now on is going to be mostly you. I may interject a few things here and there. But I know that you have three books that you are either working on or they're ready to be printed. I don't know which. You're going to tell us that.
Yep.
So however you want to put it together, whichever books you want to talk about first, second, third, that's all up to you. So I'll let you start.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, today is a special day for me because I have actually got two books published on the same day. Two books came out today, so that's the first for
me.
Wow. I have one book with Crazy Eight Press, and I have one book that I've published on my own. So, those books came out today. I'll talk about the Progenitor book first of all. I'll give you a little bit of a background on that. It's the first book I published with Crazy Eight Press, and it's essentially a 1940s period sci-fi horror. It's set during World War II, and we see an America under attack from strange monsters that no one really understands where they sprang from. It's a story set in the backdrop of war, but far enough away from it that it hardly features at all. A cataclysmic event in Washington, D.C. Finds the city destroyed by monsters, and a group of survivors are led by General William Marshall and a British colonel. I always have to have a British guy in there, you know. they find solitude in Camp Detrick, a place set up specifically to deal with the type of disasters that has disconnected America with the rest of the world. But once they get inside, our heroes discover a far bigger threat in the work conducted by scientists led by a German, Dr. Hans Gruner. And without going into too much detail, giving too much away, if you think Alien meets The Thing, you'll have a pretty good idea of how awful their situation is about to get. So that's Progenitor. And that came out, Crazy Eight Press is all one word, with the eight as the number eight, .com. They have published that book. It is available on Amazon, and like you say, if you go to Amazon with my name, you'll find it. That's available in ebook and in paperback. I will be getting a small selection of the paperbacks from the press, which I can then send out signed or autographed copies for people if they would like. So that's that book, and I'm very happy with it. It was a very interesting ride with that book because it was the first time I'd sort of stepped out of my fantasy, sort of Egyptian fantasy series that I'd been writing for 4 years straight. And I'm going to talk about the book Citadel of Ra, which was the other book that came out today, in a moment. But I wanted to do something completely different from what I'd done before. And when I presented it to the Crazy Eight Press team, they liked it. So I was very happy by that. And yeah, it's a one and done book. And it's been a while since I've done that because most of my books have always been serial. So I've always had the next book in mind pretty much afterwards. And I'm not going to lie and say I didn't think about doing a part two. But when I left it alone for a little bit of time and went back to it and read through it again, I realized it didn't need it. It absolutely didn't need it. It's a one-book story, and that's it. So I'm very happy with it, and I'm very happy with, so far, the response has been pretty good to a few people that have only got it today and have read most of it. Some people have read very, very quickly, so I've had some very good feedback already, which was lovely. It's fantastic. So that's Progenitor. And the other book that came out today was The Citadel of Ra. The ebook is available. The paperback is still being worked on because there have been some issues with the publishing side because of COVID. And I did run a Kickstarter campaign, and I'm waiting to be able to fulfill some of those requirements, but I did send out the ebooks to everybody today, even if they didn't order one, just so that they had a copy. But yeah, I'm having a little bit of trouble getting all of that done. But this book, really, the Songs of Osirian series, I started in 2016, and it's been a labor of love for these 4 years. And it was sort of bittersweet when I came to conclude the book because, and initially I had it. I had it sort of scoped out for five books, but when I really sat down and worked out what I wanted to do with the last book and how I wanted to conclude an entire series. Because when you write one book and then you just write a sequel to it, you kind of don't have to worry too much about the bigger picture, in the sense that you don't have to wrap up all the loose ends, because you know at some point at the end of the series you're going to be able to do that. And then when you hit that last book and you think, oh, wow, so I've got to go through all these threads from the first, second, and third books and make sure they all tie together, and, you know. And so I had planned it out over two books, but Daughter of Ra, which was the third book, had quite a lot of those threads tied up, and it really left it for me to be able to just tell an end story without too much what I call fluff. I'm sure we've all read book series where we get to the last book and it's five times bigger than all the others, and if you'd cut out a third of it, you know, would have still been just as easy to read and understand. So I was very careful with what I put in, that I made sure that it wasn't padded in any way, and when I did that, I realized it was just one book. So I'll give you a little overview of the Songs of the Assyrian, or Assyrian. Everyone says those words differently, and I interchange them. I never know what the correct pronunciation is. I probably should learn it, but it doesn't matter. Songs of the Assyrian is a character-driven series centered around mankind's struggle to overcome the powerful beast. Beast is like my big bad in this series of books. His domination of the world has practically destroyed it. But with the help of seemingly all-powerful ancient Egyptian gods, their chances of success against Beast increases somewhat. But even Anubis, Osiris, Horus, and all the other gods are not immune to the power and influence of Beast himself. So at the end of the day, the entire story is about mankind's sort of existence, which stands right on the brink of extermination. And alongside them are these powerful, powerful gods that are, over time, their own powers are diminishing, and they're not quite as powerful as they used to be. And it gets to a point where, through the series, we get to the point where mankind and gods rub shoulder to shoulder, because whilst the gods don't lose their powers entirely, it gets to a point where the two groups work together, and they work together in harmony, you know, side by side, rather than the gods looking down on them, which was where I really wanted to get to. But even then, their outcome is hardly certain. But from the camaraderie, I wanted to get this sort of auspice of hope. You know, we've lived in a world where hope has seemed quite out of reach, and I wanted to make sure that hope was still there for people, even in the darkest of times. And so there is a little mirroring of real life events in this last book, because, you know, I wrote it in the middle of a pandemic, so of course there's going to be some elements of that slipping in. But love, hope and love are the two main themes for this series, and these are powerful sort of beyond magic. They transcend the magic of gods and so on. These are things that gods, people and so on can get more from. So I use those terms quite a lot in the book. And essentially, man has to learn to overcome their own prejudices, their own fears of each other, and trust in gods who weren't always benevolent and nice. And once they can get to that point and start working together to try and resolve this entire problem, it might just be enough, you know, to win the war. But equally, these gods who are used to looking down on people and seeing them as insignificant, you know, or tools or so on, have to suddenly learn some empathy and humility and recognize that because of their own diminishing powers, they become reliant on these people who have sort of powers of their own, but they don't understand, like emotions, like love and so on. So it's a story about really love and hope, but we have the backdrop of this sort of cataclysmic event that caused the whole world to end. And hopefully the resolution is puts a smile on people's faces. I mean, obviously, there's going to be characters in the book. They're going to have different journeys, and some of those characters might not make it to the end of the book, and that's sad. But I hope that when people read it, that concluding part of that story gives them a sense that, you know, things will turn out well if they work hard to make them. So that's that book. The other one you mentioned, or the other books I have when we last spoke, the Holmes book had just come out, and I'm very pleased to tell you that that book has done very well. In fact, it's probably done better than any of the books that I've written, and because of that, I penned a second book called The Curse of Pharaoh, which is scheduled for publication at the end of January. So it's not too long for people to wait for that one. Another novella, so it's about 50,000 words. It's a little smaller than a full-size novel. But they're not dependent. You don't have to read one to read the next one. They're Sherlock Holmes stories that are completely separate from each other, separate cases and so on. But I'd written a short story called Sherlock Holmes, The Egyptian Ring, which I actually included as a bonus in the paperback version of A Scandalous Affair. And that was the inspiration for The Curse of Pharaoh. And I took that short story and I actually turned it into a full story with a totally different story itself, but there are elements of that short story that people will see in there. Because the feedback and the response to it has been phenomenal. I was taken aback by just how much people love Sherlock Holmes, and I know because I'm a Sherlock Holmes fan, but just how much people were, you know, consistently downloading the book or purchasing the book or reading the book. It's been very very humbling to know that my book has been read by the amount of people it has. I mean, I think in the last count, since the 1st of December, since the 1st of September when it came out, I've had just under 19,000 page reads.
Wow.
For a book that's 150 pages in size. Yeah, so that's huge for me. I think my entire page reads for last year was like 10,000. And this one book has doubled what I did for my entire stock of books from last year. So I'm super, super happy about that.
No, I'm sure. Wow. Well, people love Sherlock Holmes. I mean, I know I do. I love Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, they do. And I think there's a great mixture of fans across the board, which, of course, is why it has survived as long as it has and why people love it. There are the people who are purist Holmes fans that like it to be exactly as Conan Doyle envisaged it, which is what I attempt to do. There are fans that like to see Holmes and Watson, you know, either swapping gender or, you know, having a relationship with themselves or other people. And then there are the fans of people who like the Sherlock Holmes idea, but perhaps set in the future or perhaps set in an alternate reality where Holmes wasn't a man, he was a woman, and so on and so on. And I think that that kind of diversity in the fanship is fabulous because it gives us, it gives people like me an opportunity to write in any genre that I think people are going to enjoy. And sometimes these fan groups don't cross because the people who like pure Holmesian style works are unlikely to read anything outside of that. But, you know, the BBC did a fabulous show called Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch. And that was an alternate Sherlock Holmes. It was a Sherlock Holmes in the 21st century where the stories from the original series were re-penned and created to fit our world, and a Sherlock Holmes created to fit our world, and a Dr. Watson created in that way too. And I love them. And as much as I'm a purist Holmes fan, I think that Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss, who wrote that series, did a fabulous, fabulous job with it. But then I'm a little biased because they also did, you know, two whole series of Doctor Who, and Matt Smith and Peter Capaldi's term as the Doctor was overseen by showrunner Stephen Moffat and, of course, Mark Gatiss. And the two of them also went on and did the Dracula series, which came out. So there's a link to that, which, of course, is all very interconnected because I like the writing. So it makes it easier for me to like those series as well.
Well, yeah. I mean, some people won't cross those lines, like you said, like if they're a purist, they don't want to read one that's in the future. But there are some, like me, and this is true of anything I'm a fan of, at least usually, I may like the what you would call canon stuff, but I also can enjoy the stuff that isn't, the stuff that's different, that changes things up a little bit. So it just depends, like you said, on the writing. If it's good writing, I can enjoy it, even though it's not the same as what I'm used to.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right. And I think the thing is that, you know, we see a lot of diversity in the fan bases of any franchise show or series. Star Trek has its massive cross-connect with fans who love, you know, the original series, and then, you know, maybe they like The Next Generation or Voyager or Deep Space Nine, but then hated Enterprise or didn't like Picard, a new series, or didn't like Discovery or whatever. And their reasons obviously all vary. Some people just don't like the writing. Some people don't like the direction the characters went. Very hard. I think the same thing happened in Star Wars. And I do understand it to a degree because, you know, when you have a character, for example, like Luke Skywalker, who you grew up with and watched defeat all the big baddies, and then you see him come to life on the screen, you know, 30 or 40 years, however long it was later, and he hasn't gone in the direction you assumed he would, you can be disappointed.
Right.
I think that must be very hard for a franchise to say, we're going to take these characters in a new direction. I mean, with Captain Picard in the Picard series, I remember reading an article from Patrick Stewart saying that, you know, if they just wanted him to sit in a captain's chair saying, make it so, and all that, that was not what he wanted. He'd done that to death, and they had to come up with an alternative idea to make him want to come back and do it again, you know, make him want to revisit a character that he had been happily put to bed. And so with that comes this dynamic new idea and new retelling of it to give Patrick Stewart the opportunity to play Captain Picard differently, or Jean-Luc Picard differently. And, of course, that would not please the fans who expected him to be the head of Starfleet or running the ship or, you know, whatever their idea was of him in 30 years in the future. And suddenly he's not doing those things. It's not – that's already going to set them off. And I think it's the same with Doctor Who, for example, where after 50-odd years of male actors playing the titular role of the Doctor, suddenly we have a female regeneration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this blew people's minds. I mean, yes, they had been carefully twisting in the idea that the Doctor's regenerations aren't actually specifically gender-related, and he can or she can become whichever gender they choose. And, of course, we saw some of the characters like Missy, who turned up, who was a female regeneration of the Master, who had also been in the series since the 70s and always been male. So we knew that that was a potential, and I think a lot of us sort of saw it coming because there was a bit more of a constant reference to the gender of Time Lords being different or being diverse. But you'll see this fanship where people have utterly abandoned the show because of that, and as far as they can show, the show, the love for the show they have is gone because of that sort of change. And I do understand why people do it. I do understand why people get upset with a character. So it's very, very hard when you're a writer to say, well, I'm going to write my own characters and that's fine because they're mine and I can do with them what I want. But I also have to be aware of if people like those characters or they've, you know, read enough of my stories to say, oh, you know, I really care for that character. Then I have a dilemma about where I go with that character, especially if my next job was to plan to kill him off. And, you know, you don't want to fall into the trap of saying, oh, I'm going to kill him off. And then everybody goes, oh, no, I love him. And they go, oh, well, he wasn't really dead. I mean, Tony Conan Doyle had the same problem. He had written enough Sherlock Holmes stories. He had done Sherlock Holmes to death. As far as he was concerned, he was happy to let him die, and he wanted his his literary work that was not fictional to be more recognized, and so he wrote The Final Problem and had Holmes and Moriarty disappear off the Reichenbach Falls, and to his mind, the end. But I think there was a twofold lure that brought him back. One was that his non-fictional literary work was not getting the readership that he had hoped, and secondly, I don't think it was making him the money that he had hoped. And mm-hmm. I think one of the sure bets for him was Sherlock Holmes would always bring in the cash. So I think that, from my understanding, from what I've read in articles and interviews with him, that was his decision, was to bring him back because, you know, the love for Holmes just got bigger and bigger after he had died. And then, of course, when he did bring him back, you know, he did very famously well from Sherlock Holmes. And I live not far from a place here, Gillette's Castle, it's called, where William Gillette owned the castle, I believe he did well. And he is widely recognized as one of the original sort of who set up the Sherlock Holmes, or our view of what Sherlock Holmes is visually. Because, of course, he was doing a lot of stage plays in America as Sherlock Holmes, and I think across the world. And he was the one that, you know, produced the deerstalker and the big pipe and the double-flapped cape. And those things are recognizably Sherlock Holmes. And William Gillette is the man that actually, you know, made those things visible and made them a standard. And it's really interesting when you think this guy was doing that with the blessing of Conan Doyle. They wrote plays together. Some of these plays still exist now. And at this castle where I live, they do enactments and so on of those plays. And it's very interesting and very nice to be sort of surrounded by the history that I had no idea was here until I started looking deeper into it. So that was all the basis behind me writing a Sherlock Holmes story. I wrote a short story 20 years ago and thought, no, I'm never going to be able to publish it because, you know, copyright and so on. When it became in the public domain, with certain rules that you have to be aware of, because, of course, in America, the copyright law is different from the UK, 70 years in the UK and 100 years in the US. So there are stories written in the 1920s that are still within copyright, so you can't address certain things within those. For example, you know, if Holmes has any kind of emotions or shows any kind of emotions, they were really only in those books in the 20s, so that's something you have to avoid. And in fact, I think the Enola Holmes TV show, which is, I think, the sister of Sherlock Holmes, which was a fabulous show. I think it's on Netflix. It's absolutely fabulous. I loved it. But they're under a bit of pressure now from the Conan Doyle estate because they gave Holmes a bit of emotion, and they're using that as a crux to hit them with lawsuits now, which is surprising. Well, it's not surprising, but it's a little disappointing. But, you know, this is an organization that is fiercely loyal to the Conan Doyle, you know, estate, but have no connection with the author really, other than that, you know, directly through blood, and have no connection to the writings. I mean, at least Christopher Tolkien actually helped rewrite some of his father's books prior to publishing them. So you can say that he has a stake in that. So it's a little disappointing, but so you just have to be a bit careful about that. But after 2023, that won't be an issue because that's when the last book comes out of copyright, and then it's totally public domain in the U.S.
Mm. Wow, yeah, that's all very interesting. So
you
now, when you're writing, your the ones that you have more, you know, the series of books, is the second and the third one and so on, do they get easier as you go along, or do they get more difficult?
That's a very good question. The first book, well, the first book was actually came from, again, a short story. I wrote a short story for a publisher in London called Media Bitch Literary Agency, and they wanted a story about the chief protagonist being a antagonist, or being a lion or a monster or a creature or something. And I'd written this short story, and I liked it so much that when we signed contracts and so on, I said that I would like to retain the rights to the book, to the idea of the book, so that I could redevelop it and so on, and they were fine with that. So I managed to do that, and that's where the Songs of the Osirian book came along. The Rise of the Jackal King I actually wrote a year later, and I think the only thing that I did when I sat down to write that, I made one tiny mistake, and that was that I had a specific voice in the first book that I really liked. I just sat down and watched a series called Spartacus, and I'd watched all of them, and they're pretty grotesque, but I loved it. But they had a style of speech and a style of talking that I really enjoyed, so I kind of integrated that into my ideas. But when I wrote the second book, I didn't use the same voice. I used the voice that all of the other books now have. And so the first book got kind of, well, the first review I got for the book was it was almost a sort of biblical kind of end of world. Whereas the second book is a little bit more uplifting and so on, because of course we've gone past that and it's a few years later and so on. So to answer your question, each book in essence, once I had the ideas set and where I wanted to go with them, were not difficult to write, because you probably heard this from writers before, but they did tend to write themselves. I listened to my characters a lot, and they talked to me in my sleep and so on. The hardest book to write was the fourth book, and the reason for that was because I was coming to the end of the series. It was an emotional journey for me. I knew where I wanted to go with the story. I knew where I wanted the characters to end up. But when I finished the first draft, and my partner will tell you, I was in floods of tears over it, because of course it was, you know, ending of the book. But I really did not like the end. I penned it that way, I'd outlined it that way, but when I got to the end, I felt let down by it personally myself, and I thought, well, if I feel like that, then I think people might do as well. Now, I don't know, because they're probably not as emotionally invested in this. I mean, that had come at a time where my father had not long died. We were then on lockdown, you know, and awful things were going on in the world, and it was all very depressing, and I think what had happened is some of that, or a lot of that, had seeped into it. So I went back and I thought, nope, I have to lighten this and give it some, you know, yes, we're going to have tears, you know, it's inevitable, but we need to end in a state that this isn't the end, this is just the new beginning, and that's where I went with it. So that was the hardest thing, but the hardest part was actually ending it. I spent a lot of time afterwards, you know, redeveloping it, my second draft, you know, trimming it down, wanting to add more, and still months later thinking, well, maybe I could add another chapter about that. And it's that old story, isn't it? You know, the painting that you never quite finish. And I had to be a little bit more like, I had to come to a point where I said, this is it, it's over, stop, move on. And so shortly after that, I started writing the progenitor book. And that actually started out as a prequel idea for this whole series. But then a very, very good friend of mine, Mr. Michael Jan Friedman, said, it's time to put it to bed. It's time you wrote something new. You know, you can always revisit it later at some point down the line, but it's too fresh and too... You're too emotionally invested in it. It's time to move on. And it was good advice, and that's why I eventually went with this version of that book. And, of course, you know, Mike being a part of the Crazy A Press team was instrumental in getting that published by them. So I'm very happy that he gave me that advice. When a New York Times bestselling author gives you advice, you damn well should listen.
Oh, well, yeah. And people love aliens and, you know, the thing. Well, the thing was an alien, but, you know, they love that kind of stuff. Very popular.
I think so, and I'm a mystery writer at heart, and so, or at least I used to be. That's the big thing. So getting back to writing outside of the fantasy world where it doesn't, you know, there are elements of real life in it, but the reality is that it's my world. I created it, and I know the rules, and I can change them when I sort of see fit because I have these weird and wonderful magical beings that can just do that. And then I found myself being confined back into a world set in the 1940s where there were rules and there are things you can't change and there are things that we know and understand about that period of time. And it was very hard for a while to be sort of locked into that, in the constraints of that. Oddly, though, when I went to the Holmes era of the 19th century, I found myself actually breathing a breath fresh air because then it was like, well, things were a lot easier, you know. I didn't have to worry about forensics, and I didn't have to worry about anything sort of beyond the horse and cart. And you know, there was some very easy stuff in there that allowed me to just develop the characters and push past the analysis and so on. I mean, even my 1930s mystery books, I was cheeky and deliberately set them in the 30s and 40s, so I didn't have to worry about CSIing anything. Because, you know, I don't have all of that knowledge to understand all the forensic information that you need. You know, all you need to do is say, well, the boys in the lab identified that carpet fiber, you know, that's good enough for me. That's not what my story's about. And I think Agatha Christie did a good job of that too, because Poirot, for example, was not interested in footprints or cigarette ash or any of those clues. He was interested in the psychology of what went on, and that's where I have always leant towards. So writing Sherlock Holmes was interesting because, of course, you have to have Holmes do his wonderful, you know, I see by your left shoe that you were, you know, you walk in the East End of London at night on a Friday. You know, you have to be able to make up these sort of startling deductions, but then you have to be able to explain them logically, as Conan Doyle did, so they're not just arbitrary and silly. You know, recently been to China was one that I always thought was interesting, and he said, how the devil could you know that? And he said, well, you know, you have a tattoo of a fish, and that pink scaling is peculiar to Chinese tattooists, and it's not peculiar to ones, and so on. And that's sort of, okay, I understand that. And I think that sort of deductive science stuff is important. But you can also overuse it. You can also be too reliant on it. I mean, I think in the same way that perhaps in Doctor Who, the Doctor becomes very reliant on this sonic screwdriver toy that can get him out of any situation. I think Tom Baker said it very well when he said, the sonic screwdriver can open every single door in the universe. Unless, of course, it can't. And I think that's the thing about writing Sherlock Holmes stuff is that, you know, you want Holmes to be clever. You want him to be able to solve it. You want him to be able to come up with answers that no one else could have. But I went down the route of saying that my Holmes and Watson were essentially the Jeremy Brett, Edward Hardwick portrayals from the Granada TV series in the United Kingdom. And with that in mind, I really molded the characters around their performances and how they interacted with each other. And so my Watson isn't an idiot, and he's not just walking around saying, I say, Holmes, good grief, Holmes, you know, and all the sort of stuff that we've seen on TV and films. This is an intelligent man. This is a doctor, for goodness sake, in the 19th century. He's highly educated. Yes, he doesn't have the mental reasoning, but Sherlock Holmes was Superman of his time. He just didn't have a cape. He had a deerstalker and a pipe. And so nobody's going to be able to meet him other than his own brother, of course, who was actually a little better. So it was really important that the development of that relationship didn't cross any boundaries for the people who like purism, but also actually gave Watson a bit more of a voice, because Watson's narration is always, you know, from his point of view, obviously, and never really kind of, he doesn't really say too much about Holmes's how Holmes irritates him, how Holmes can be very imperious and rude, and often puts Watson in mortal peril with a quick flick of his wrist, and says afterwards, "Well, my dear fellow, you know, I knew that, but you know, I never expected this to happen." When, you know, other than that particular one instance, everything else he expected to happen perfectly and did. So I wanted to develop a little bit of the personal relationship between the two of them. And in the Scandalous Affair, I touched on it briefly, but in The Curse of Pharaoh, I actually do have them have a frank discussion about how Holmes can sometimes use Watson a little more than Watson likes. I touch the boundary a little bit perhaps, but I think it's important nowadays for people to say, you know, well, that sort of behavior isn't acceptable. Holmes killed, you know, what did Conan Doyle do? He had Holmes fake his own death and live abroad for 2-3 years, make everybody believe he was dead, including his most trusted friend, and then just turn up and say, "Do you mind if I smoke a cigarette in your consulting lounge?" And like it's all a big joke.
Yeah.
And I think that it was handled well in, say, the Sherlock series, where Watson just basically punches Sherlock in the face. But in the original series, it's more along the line of, you know, "Oh, well, you know, I totally understand. Now you've explained it to me, Holmes. It's perfectly fine that I have been in utter misery for 3 years, and now suddenly I'm elated by that you're alive and well. Let's go on a case together." So I don't know if that's, you know, people would say that's the Holmes and Watson as it's written, so you shouldn't change it. But I think that there should be a little bit more of the, I know the Victorian attitude suggests that they wouldn't have those kinds of discussions, and certainly not necessarily be written down. But I have my Watson, the foreword for Scandalous Affair is from Watson in the 1920s. So he's a little bit more open about some of the difficulties. And I think it's really important that we see these different men, because the Watson and Holmes from 1887 is not the same Watson and Holmes from 1903.
Right. Well, yeah, they wouldn't be. Yeah, I like the all the different Holmes. I shouldn't say I like them all, but I like the idea of them, the way they have so many different ways to put it together, even when they're comedic, like Sherlock Holmes's smarter brother.
Yes. I think there was a film, I think, that was Ben Kingsley and Michael Caine, called Without a Clue, and the idea was that Watson was actually the detective and intelligent, and he wrote the stories, and he had invented Sherlock Holmes, who was played by Michael Caine, who was an actor.
Right.
He just acted the part whilst Watson solved the crimes, but when he wrote it, in order to hide himself, he created this character of Sherlock. I thought the idea was very clever, and I thought it was, you know, I mean, back then it was very clever. Now I think people have, you know, used that as a ruse in some of their writings in the future. I don't think it did particularly well as a film, but I think I've loved everything Sherlock Holmes, but I have to say, and I know that I get a little hate for this, but I did not enjoy the Robert Downey Jr. Versions of the Sherlock Holmes series at all. Although they were, in their own way, great stories. And the actors are fabulous. I mean, you know, you've got great people in them who I really like watching, including Stephen Fry as Sherlock Holmes' brother. But I didn't care for the way they tried to steampunk Holmes and Watson in this weird sort of fishbowl Victorian world that really couldn't possibly exist. So I didn't really care for that, and that's the first time. But it didn't stop me watching them, and it didn't stop me enjoying them as films. But as Sherlock Holmes and Watson, I didn't think Robert Downey Jr. played a very good Sherlock Holmes at all. I think he did a, he did a Robert Downey Jr. version of it, which wasn't for me.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, because like with the Star Trek that you were talking about earlier. Okay, now the 2009 movie where they basically changed everything because it was in a different universe. That's all well and good. I didn't mind that at all. But when they were advertising it, they advertised it as a prequel. And
That's
it was
right.
not a prequel because everybody was different. And they were different because they're in an alternate universe. And that's one of the things that people didn't like. Because if you
I agree.
think of the TV series, the TV series, all the different TV series, when it went from the original and then when the Next Generation came along, they got a whole new crew and there was a bunch of different people. And then when Deep Space Nine came along, they got a whole bunch of new people, except for, a couple, like Worf was in that, but basically all new people. And then when Voyager came along, all new people. And even Enterprise, which I really didn't like Enterprise, I, for whatever reason, I'm not exactly sure, but I didn't really like it. But even that show had all different people. And they weren't supposed to be anybody from any other show. So I didn't see why they felt the need for the 2009 movie to say that they were Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. Why didn't they just say that they were other people?
Their own crew of a new ship or something. I think the sad thing is that in order to sell it as a film franchise, I think, because the idea, of course, was to plan a number of films in that franchise to do a sort of a reset to create all of these younger versions of the characters. I liked the idea. I did like the idea of it. And like you say, I was a bit confused by the concept when it first came out. My problem with them, I thought they were fabulous films. I loved the films, but they didn't give me the same feel of Star Trek that I'm used to. Set aside on their own, they were great films. The thing that bothered me the most, which of course is not really a big thing for most people, but the thing that bothered me the most about not that one, but the one that came after, I think, was when they reintroduced Khan from an earlier point in his history, because in the original series, Khan was found in the ship, lost in space. And then in this series, they found Khan and they reanimated him or unfroze him or whatever. And instead of being Khan Noonien Singh, of course, who was from Indian descent, they had Ricardo Montalban play it. And of course, they darkened him and gave him long, dark hair in the original series. They got Benedict Cumberbatch to play him, who I just could not understand that casting. Change the rules, make him come out earlier than he did. You've already created a new universe, that's fine. But this is the wrong actor for that role. Totally wrong. This is a man, and they don't even call him Khan Singh. It didn't make any sense to me. That is another one, and I think it absolutely says to your point. Why have him as Khan at all? Why not just have him as another baddie? They wanted to reproduce Star Trek II because, of course, they did in that film the same sequence where somebody had to save the ship, so somebody had to go into the reactor core. And of course, in this instance, it was Kirk, not Spock, because that was the change, and so on. And so there were elements that were filtering alongside it. As films, as independent films, I thought they were great. And I think if you go back to the 1960s, there was when Doctor Who first started in the UK in 1963, when William Hartnell was playing the Doctor, it was all black and white TV and it was a BBC low budget, Then Peter Cushing came along and did two films, Doctor Who and the Daleks and Doctor Who Space or Earth 2150 AD. And they were based off of episodes from the series, and they were totally rewritten with new people, none of the actors from the TV show. They were a film budget. They were a big budget film. They were in color. Doctor Who was called Doctor Who. He wasn't an alien. He was a human who built his own TARDIS in his backyard that somehow managed to make it bigger on the inside than out. You know, it was lots of little things. And I'm like, why would they do that? Why would they create an entirely different thing with elements of the original thing whilst the original thing is still going? So, I have little issues with that.
Yeah, that's the problem with doing that kind of stuff because, okay, you've already got a fan base. So,
yeah.
And with Star Trek, it's like the biggest fan base on the planet. Now, why would you want to upset that fan base? And the reason why a lot of people didn't like that, it's not that they didn't like the 2009 movie. What they didn't like was how J.J. Abrams, and I remember specifically how he said this, he pretty much said, you know, to hell with the fans. But what he said, and I quote him, "I've always hated Star Trek. And I'm going to make it into what I want it to be, and I don't care what the fans think."
Right. And, of course, he was
That put a lot of fans off. But he loved Star Wars. So when he got Star Wars, he was more faithful to that because he always liked Star Wars. So
You can argue either way. I mean, I think personally that I think what they tried to do with the Star Trek was fine. And I say, I love the movies and I love the acting. I mean, all of the actors cast were very good and some of them were exceptionally good. I think you can argue the opposite with the Star Wars thing in the sense that it was, you know, it didn't hit home for a lot of Star Wars fans. I think series like The Mandalorian are doing that better. Clone Wars, you know, Rebels,
right,
they did that a lot better with fans. The Rogue One film, I think, was probably, in my opinion, the better of nearly all of the newer films. I think it's the best, and the Solo film, again, was good. But I do see your point. I think when you come into a franchise that has been around for a long time, you know, it's hard. Like Supernatural, for example, I think it's just finished its, 15th season, and it's just ended. And, of course, like all shows that come to an end, nobody liked the ending. How can they? How can the writers wrap up 15 years worth of this show in one episode and not upset people? I mean, I feel like that every sort of season finale episode has got something to upset someone because they go, oh, I didn't want that to happen, or I didn't want my favorite character to X, or, you know. So I think it's very hard, but I think it's equally hard when you come in and say, hey, new writer, we're writing a new Star Trek show, but we don't want you to look at the past. We just want you to write something from now in the future. Don't look back at the past. We're not interested in making those connected dots. And you think, well, hold on a second. There's like a million books. There's 40 years of history, you know. I mean, I'm connected with at least 6 or 7 Star Trek authors who are currently writing Star Trek Discovery books, Picard books, and so on. I don't think you can. I don't think you can just go, I'm not going to look at any of that. And I think that felt like the 2009 film felt like I want to do something brand new and I want to make it look a bit like Star Trek, but I want to take away all of the sort of science-y, exploration-y stuff and make it a little bit more shooty up, bang, bang, which did appeal to a younger base of fans. I mean, that's the sad reality of it, is that most of the fans who are complaining about Star Wars and Star Trek, certainly in this 2000 on, are the people that grew up with it. And it's 30, 40 years of their life. And I grew up with it, and I, like, don't want you to change it. I didn't like The Last Jedi at all in Star Wars. I didn't like it at all. But I do understand why younger fans are saying, I don't understand what the problem is, because they haven't seen any of the other stuff.
Well, what I brought up with younger people you know, depending on how young. But there are younger people that are fans of, like, The Lord of the Rings. And
yes.
I would say to them, okay, you like Lord of the Rings, right? That's a series. Now, how would you like it if they took all the characters that you know and they just made them all different with no explanation?
Yeah, right.
And they
exactly.
went, well, of course I wouldn't like that. And I said, that's the problem with the 2009 Star Trek. I said, yes, it's explained at the end, but and anybody who's ever seen a Star Trek can figure it out that that's what it is because they're not acting like themselves. But that's why people had a problem with it. Because you know what I said to plenty of people? It was simple what they could have done, and we've only got a couple minutes, actually. That's interesting. All they would have had to do to please me and millions of lifelong Star Trek fans is to start out like what an episode of The Next Generation started out, where they're on the ship in the present universe, whatever that universe is of Star Trek. And then something happens, and they go, oh, and then everything changes right on the screen, and then go into that new universe. If they would have done, oh yeah, and then at the end, have everything go back.
Bit,
I would have been
yesterday's
happy.
Yesterday's Enterprise, yeah.
Exactly. That's exactly
yeah, I
what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would have been happy with that.
A visual change that you see immediately on screen that makes it obvious. Yeah, no, I think that's a... That's actually a very, very useful way of being able to tell different stories, too.
Well, it would have explained why they were all acting differently. Because, like I said, why call them Kirk, McCoy, and Spock if you're not going to have them be Kirk, McCoy, and Spock? Just give them different names, and like what they did through all the TV shows, like what we said earlier. But anyway, I'm sorry to get off on that.
No, that's fine.
We've got like just 3 minutes left, so actually I'll just let you go ahead and say anything you want to say. Like maybe you want to mention Chase Masterson's Pop Culture Hero Coalition again and have people tell people how they can contribute.
Yeah, absolutely. The coalition is primarily there to create an environment that is against anti-bullying and so on. They do a lot of work with schools and children. They produce a lot of documents and information packs that help to understand what bullying really is. Because bullying isn't just about bullying children, it's about bullying anyone. Everybody gets bullied at some point in their life. But it's now a global organization, which is great. And it actually has representation, in the United Nations, which is pretty huge for the organization.
Anybody
wants to get in contact with Pop Culture Hero Coalition, it's pretty simple. If you go onto Facebook or Instagram or any of those places and just type superhero, or one word, IRL in real life. So it's superhero IRL. That will come up with Pop Culture Hero Coalition. You can donate. You can buy product. They have a fantastic merch run by a great guy called Raymond Litster, and he organizes all their merch. And the Be Kind merch is pretty classy. You know, it's got a lot of different ranges. It's really nice. All of that money goes to fund the coalition. So that's a big boon. I always say, do good, feel good, and look good. And these are all the things that make you good. But if you go to my website, again, there's links on there. So www.cdanabbott.com, and you can get links to that and everything that I do. I also have a little selection of YouTube videos that I've made as well. So if you're not tired of my voice by now, then you can go and watch something and hear some more and actually see me.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for all of that information. We've only got a few seconds left. So So is there anything that you want to say in closing that would only take maybe 20 seconds?
Yes, thank you very much for having me back on your show. I've enjoyed every moment of it.
Oh, and thank you very much for being back on the show. Christopher D. Abbott, it has been a joy. Thank you so much. And stay safe, and I wish you much success with those newest books and with anything else you have coming out in the future. Thanks again, and goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.
All right. Bye.